Session number 10039, reel 3.
Reel 3. Now, but if the river wasn't too wide, there would be a cable running across the river which the barge would be hooked onto. But if it was too wide for that, then they would push off and they would go quite a long way downstream, sometimes a mile and a half downstream, with everybody yelling and shouting, with the barge occasionally turning round in the semi-rapids till it finally reached the other side, and then it would be hauled up, you'd take your trucks off, and the coolies would pull it back then upstream, and it would start all over again. And that was quite exciting travelling.
Sounds quite hazardous, too.
It was fairly hazardous, I think, at times. The other thing was that whenever you arrived in your in a village to stay for the night, you'd find the nearest Fandi inn, where you'd have a meal, and then the chaps always slept on the trucks for a number of reasons. One is, of course, you could protect what was on the trucks because of the extreme poverty of the country. There was a fair amount of pilfering, if at all possible, so that it was a guard against that. Sometimes you'd be put up at mission stations. And one of the things which saddened me a great deal, and I think saddened a lot of our chaps, was that often when you'd go to a mission station, the missionaries were prepared to put you up and give you a meal, but they wouldn't put your Chinese drivers up and give you a meal. It was this superior Western attitude to the Chinese. And, of course, we all being the same level and being the rebels that we are, we all elected to either have a meal together or not at all. And I think this was... And I think this endeared us, if that's the word, to a lot of our Chinese colleagues.
Yes, do you think, you know, you presented a very different image of Westerners to what...
Oh, I'm sure we did. And if I could give you a little incident on that, when we were in Hankou, there was a lovely English doctor, Dr. Kundal, a real marvellous fellow, gracious English gentleman. And one day he sent me out to the hospital gate to get a rickshaw for one of the patients. And being Lindsay Crazier, I said to the rickshaw chappie, "You hop in." I put his hat on and I jogged up the drive with this chappie sitting in the rickshaw. Dear old Dr. Kundal, he wasn't hurt, he was appalled. I'd let the empire down. It wasn't done, Lindsay. It's not done. See? And he would say to me sometimes, I'd have a mechanic, an assistant there. And if we having a morning tea, I would always bring him into the house to have morning tea with me. But he would say, look at me and say, "Lindsay, you know, you're far too democratic." But see, we from New Zealand have no colour bar, or haven't had, and no racial distinctions. We haven't had this tradition of the Western people who have been colonising. We're not a colonising power. And I think this attitude ran right through the New Zealanders. And so this is one of the things we found, a lot of our other colleagues found this very hard to get over too. The superior attitude of Westerners to their Asian colleagues. Right.
And particularly the missionaries. You know, yes. Did that shock you that it should be missionaries?
It shocked me immensely because I'd been brought up within the framework of the Christian Church. The missionaries were the saints who represented the Christian Church in the foreign field. And it comes a bit of a blow when you realise that they have these faults, what I would call faults, as much as anybody else. And so this was a bit of a shock, I must confess. And I recognise it's not easy. You couldn't live, let's be honest, healthily with a lot of people that you associate with. And so the mission folks tended to congregate together in their compounds with their particular comforts. And so on. And it was a long, long time before the church got round to recognizing that a Chinese pastor should receive the same salary as a Western pastor, despite all his allowances, because the Westerner had so many other things to upkeep. So that's one of the shocks.
Where would you have been when the war ended?
Oh, we were in this village called Jujing. And I remember there were great celebrations that night, of course. And somebody said, the peace has broken out. And the only time that I remember ever seeing a Chinese drunk was, there was a drunk soldier came up to me to greet me as a foreigner, because there were very few Westerners in Jujing. He had a Tommy gun in his hand, and he pushed it right in my face, and you could smell the hot barrel and the hot cordite. And he said, Ding Hao. Now, Ding Hao was a greeting, which I think came from the Americans, which means very good, Ding Hao. See, it was a common greeting. And he pushed it right in his face and said, Ding Hao. Well, I squinted down the barrel at his finger still on the trigger and said, Ding Hao. And he lifted the gun up in the air and blazed off a whole lot of hot lead. I was never glad to get away. I never was a hero. Glad to get away from him and that, see. But then, of course, we were able to rejoice with all our friends that the war was over. And then I'm sure for them particularly, they could see the end of so much suffering, so much tragedy, that they'd be start to rebuild their lives again. Because they'd had a very, very bad time. Immense poverty and struggling and suffering.
While you were in this part of
West China,
did you come into contact with the Chinese army, you know, the Kuomintang?
Oh, yes, a lot. Mm-hmm. Because, see, what would happen was, I must make it quite clear, that the Friends Ambulance Unit was an impartial relief unit to relieve suffering wherever it was. And so we treated a lot of the derelict Kuomintang soldiers, who often, if they are injured, they would be just left in some village to find their own way home. They would come in to the hospital, sometimes in numbers, sometimes one or two straggling in, with appalling injuries and filthy clothes. And we used to make delousing plants out of gasoline drum, so that you could put all their clothes in there, delouse them. We used a lot of DDT because often these chaps would come in with, say, that had been patched up somewhere with a plaster cast on. The bed bugs had gone down the plaster cast and were giving them fits, and so we used to just pour DDT down there. And you came in and you saw these people. Their suffering must have been unbelievable. And just tossed out of the army and asked to find your own way in life. It's not much fun.
I was wondering, you know, did you form any opinion of the Kuomintang, you know, Chiang Kai-shek and the regime while
not,
you were there?
Not, this came later. Not at that stage, because by this time, of course, that the in West China, you might say, it was all Kuomintang in the Free China. It was later on when we saw something of the communists and the conflict between the two. I believe, see, that for years there had been a conflict between the Kuomintang and the communists. But they agreed to get together to drive out the Japanese. It was a very uneasy peace. And then, of course, as soon as the Sino-Japanese War finished, every endeavours were made to reconcile these two groups. But there were poles apart, and so they went their separate ways, and finally...
This, you know, the peace celebrations you're talking about, had you any idea that an atomic bomb, you know, had you any conception that had...
No, that, if I remember rightly, didn't filter through for some time because news was fairly scarce. And, of course, not having any visuals of it, we had no concept of what an atomic bomb would be like, because we hadn't had any photographs of anything of what happened. And it wasn't for some time, too, that, magazines began to come through when you realised the enormous destruction there was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki of one bomb, or two bombs, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a very well-known American magazine called I can't remember now, but it devoted the whole of its issue to Hiroshima. It was a magazine, something like Punch, you know what I mean? Americans, but I just can't think. And it devoted the whole of its issue to Hiroshima and the tragedy of the atomic bomb. Mm.
Were you surprised, though, when you heard that the war had ended?
Very much, because I'm sure... And I think, now, in retrospect, while it was an appalling tragedy, there's no doubt about it. I think it brought the Japanese conflict to an end. I'm only sorry, now, in retrospect, that the Japanese weren't able to say... The Americans weren't able to say to the Japanese, and look, we're going to carry out an experiment on a certain place. This is what one bomb will do. Now, if you don't give in, surrender, we will do this on your cities. But they didn't give them any warning, and I think this, to me, it's very hard to judge, of course.
Mm. How did this affect your time in China? You know, the fact that the war had ended. Did you alter your job? You know,
yes.
Change?
Now, then I think when the war finished, you appreciate that during the Sino-Japanese War, the French ambulance unit, whole sphere of work was in what we called West China or Free China. Now, as soon as the Sino-Japanese War finished, and as soon as possible, the emphasis for the French ambulance unit was to move into what had been occupied China, largely to take over mission hospitals, which had previously either been abandoned or taken over by the Japanese as Japanese military hospitals, get them going again and hand them back to the various missionary societies. And I was privileged to go with two other chaps to Hankou, which was a large city about 600 miles up the Yangtze River, to take over the Union Hospital, which before the war had been run by the London Missionary Society and the English Methodists. And when we arrived...
Who were the others you went with?
Oh, now I could send you that in my note, but I remember one of them, so it was Dr. Charles MacDonald, who was a Scot, but he has since died. But I could do that. When we arrived, as I say, the hospital was occupied, we understand, by about 700 Japanese prisoners of war and about 30 nurses or office girls. And it was a tragic...
Japanese nurses?
Yes, Japanese nurses. The whole thing was occupied as a Japanese military hospital. And it was a tragic sight because here they were, all these people who were dejected, demoralized, defeated, wondering what the future was going to be for them. And I would say, from a personal point of view, my most satisfactory time in China was working amongst the Japanese prisoners of war, because we were not part of a conquering army, but part of a reconciling team. And from the practical point of view, what we were able to do was to gradually get the hospital going again in a very limited way. But we were very fortunate because we hadn't been there that very long, you know, a few weeks, when there was a man called Jung Sifu turned up. And he asked us, introduced himself and told him who he was and said to go with him. We went up into the top corridor of this large hospital. He got a ladder and he broke through the ceiling, through the plaster in the ceiling, and there, hidden up in the ceiling, were great masses of beds, you name it. And what he had done, just before the Japanese OC came in, he'd taken as much hospital equipment as he could, stored it up in the attic, and then plastered the ceiling up. And it was there all during the war, and of course, this was his triumphant hour. Tremendous joy for him to think it was still there. And, of course, for us too, because hospital equipment was so short.
These Japanese prisoners, who were the Chinese guarding them?
Yes, the Chinese army were guarding the gates and round about that. But our job was to work in the hospital and gradually get it going again. Now, I became very interested in these people. Principally, I think, first of all, through the fact that I've always been very interested in mountaineering. And I had taken with me pictures of New Zealand mountains in my own ice sacks and crampons and so on, and sleeping bag and rucksack and that, I found that some of these chaps were interested in mountaineering. And so we used to abseil down the high wall of the hospital just for fun, for something to do. The other thing was, too, that I was very fortunate that I was able to get hold of a projector, a movie projector, and scrounge some films from the American Navy, who were up the Yangtze at the time, and put on picture shows for them. And so they were very interested in that because they hadn't seen movies of the West since Adam was a schoolboy. And I suppose, being kind-hearted, I got to know some of the Japanese nurses, and I was appalled to think that these lovely girls, whom I kept on liking to my sister, about the same age, were using terribly hard, crude soap for all their washing and personal laundry and that. So I went to my trunk and pulled out all the Lux and palm oil I could give them. And I suppose this is why I became their little pet. And I remember the head Japanese nurse, who was a very fine Christian, Hayakawa-san, came to me in great enthusiasm, because she said, "Lindsay-san, I'm a great admirer of Catherine Mansfield, and since she came to New Zealand, now you can tell me all about her." I said, "I'm sorry, honey, I don't know who she is. I let her down." So anyhow, but it was gradually getting to know the people. First of all, I realized that they were as glad the war was over as we were. Now, while they were defeated, and this was a terrible shock to them, because very little news had been filtering through of the, you know, the defeat, because they tried to keep up the morale. They were as glad to think that finally, all going well, they would get home. This was tremendous for them. The other thing was, too, that how I realized that we're all very much the same, and we all wanted to rejoice together. And I'll never forget the first Christmas we were there. We had a service, and there were two or three foreigners, some of our Chinese colleagues, and about 30 of the Japanese people who wanted to come along. Now, this to me was tremendous, because we gathered together to remember the Prince of Peace, as they say, within the Christian church, and forgetting and trying to forget about the war. And the other thing which impressed me too was they had an old gramophone with Beethoven and all these pieces being played by the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra, and they'd gather in this cold ward and listen to this thing for hours, because it's only part of their entertainment they could do. And so gradually we got to know each other, to try to understand each other and to reconcile together. And so this to me was a great, to me, the best part of the FAU service, really, I think. And since then, of course, I've had very good friends.
Yes. Well, do you think, you know, that going in and being pacifist made that difference, that you were able to approach the Japanese in a different way?
Oh, I'm sure that our whole attitude to the so-called enemy was this. And the thing is this, that what we tried to do, of course, was to make them recognise that we were keen about peace and wanted to, if possible, to forget the past and do something for the future. And I suppose I remember doing one thing, whether I was right or wrong, I don't know, but we heard that the Chinese army were going to come in and occupy part of the compound. So the Japanese court nurse came to me, Hayakawa-san, was terribly afraid what would happen to her nurses after the terrible things that had gone on with the rape of Nanking Sea. And fortunately, they were in a part of the compound which wasn't too big, but had a large wall around it and a fairly narrow gateway. So I said to Hayakawa-san, "We'll do two things. One, diplomatically we will try to keep them out. And the other thing is I'll try to do something practical about it." So I made a gate and covered it in copper wire, hooked it to the 230 mains with a big switch, put a lock on it, and I said, "Now look, if anybody try, put a big notice up on either side of the gate, this gate is electrified, keep out," you know what I mean? I said, "If anybody tries to break through, you pull the switch down, and I trust you, Alice, that nothing happened." But fortunately, we kept them out diplomatically. But I was glad of that too, because I'd hate to have seen anybody suffer. But they were, you can appreciate, they were in real fear. These lovely kids they were. And
that's interesting, though, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, that a pacifist should...
Well...
In extremes.
In extremes, you must do something. And all I was trying to do was to preserve the dignity of these lovely girls. It wasn't their fault that their soldiers had raped, you know, countless Chinese women and taken so many lives. And why should they suffer unnecessarily for it? And this, to me, is the sad part of war, is the retribution which goes on. And it still goes on in some people's minds. You know,
I was wondering also, Lindsay, you know, the people who were guarding the Japanese beforehand, had you heard or seen any cases of retribution or revenge?
No. The only thing was, of course, the Japanese people then would be very much like what our men were in prisons of war camps, see? Guarded, not allowed out, and so on, see? And finally, they were allowed out. Quite often, we would be the first people to take them out of the hospital compound. And I remember going into Hankow City one day, and some Europeans were coming along the footpath, and they told these Japanese to get off, so I went off with them, because this was the attitude that they took to them. The Europeans were now the conquerors. They defeated the Japanese, and so they were going to, you know, do all they could to show it. To me, this was sad, is that we keep on saying it's the innocent people who suffer in the war. Yes, and I think this was, to me, was very, very important to be, try to do all you can to demonstrate to these people that we were, and now the war was over, let's get on and get the, make the peace, the real peace.
It's interesting, you obviously form relationships with the Japanese.
Yes.
Did they know and did they understand your pacifism?
I think that they did. They perhaps couldn't understand it because we must never forget that the Japanese were subject, as we were in New Zealand, I know, to a tremendous lot of propaganda against the Westerners and so on and the Chinese. But I think that deep down, when you began to discuss with them, you know, the philosophies of life and what life's all about and what living's all about, I think they began to understand and see a little bit of it. Now, it's very hard to judge because there were very few who spoke much English. And the other thing is, too, was that it probably was quite contrary to the ethos of life, because I understand, and I may not know, but I understand that it was a great high honour for a Japanese to give his life in wartime. This is why you had these, pilots and kamikaze, is it pilots and that who would...
Kamikaze
pilots who would gradually give their life for the cause of the emperor.
I wonder also, you know, the Chinese who were about at this time,
yes,
did they understand your attitude, do you think?
I doubt it. I think they tolerated these loony Westerners. I think that's fair to say in broad terms.
Did they know about your pacifism, that you were...
Oh, yes, because, see, the thing about the ambulance unit was, it was all made up of conscientious objectors. The second thing is we never carried any arms at all. And I think, particularly on the road and that, where you'd have to take a truck through bandit-infested territories, we never carried any arms at all. And I think it was because the FAU was an impartial relief unit that I think we were asked to do some, to me anyhow, very interesting assignments. I remember when we were in Hankow, there was a request came through Dr. Leighton Stewart, who at that stage was the American ambassador in China, to see if someone could go in away through the communist lines and bring through out two UNRWA people who were held behind the communist lines. See? So three of us went in. We went in on a truck. It was a fairly rough trip in. But to make a long story short, and you don't all the details.
That would have been up north you would have gone.
Oh, no, in from the mountains from Hanko.
Yes.
To make a long story short, we finally got to this communist headquarters. And I was very impressed because they were quite shrewd, because they were virtually surrounded by the Kuomintang. And so they had their hospital in one place, their headquarters in another about 15 miles away, their printing press about another 15 miles away, and a little university and so on. So if the communists came in, they wouldn't take the whole lot at once. And I remember they were particularly asked us to go and look at their hospital unit. Well, they gave us horses to ride. Well, I walked the 15 miles home, 10 times more comfortable, through these little mountain tracks up and down, see. And the other thing that I remember was, too, that when we were at part of their university, they put on a great concert for us. It was in this enormous temple surrounded with idols in it. And all these, I think, hundreds of young students gathered there, and they put on their plays, showing how the Kuomintang were the baddies and the communists were the goodies, you know. Then they asked we foreigners to perform, but I was the only one silly enough to do it. But I remember standing up with all these idols around about. But the other interesting thing was, when we made contact with these two people, we set off to come back to Hanko. And I remember that we were held up on the way home five times by bandits or guerrillas. And they would jump out in the road and point all their rifles towards the vehicle. But I was always the Charlie that would get out and talk to them, see?
In Chinese?
In my limited Chinese, about three words, see? And I remember one little group had a wee short fellow there. He's only a bit of a kid, you know, in all due respect. But he held a grey bit of American revolver up. And I'm sure if he'd fired it, he would have gone off backwards. You know, the revolver was so big compared with him. And I being, you know, as I said before, New Zealand are fairly versatile people. I ended up by doing a Maori haka for some of them on the side of the road. But when it happens about five times in the one day, it gets a bit nerve-shattering, as you never know, because a lot of the Chinese are very much like the sentry who heard a noise and fired off and then said, who went there, you know.
Well, when you say you ended up doing Maori?
A Maori haka.
What is that?
Oh, it's a Maori war dance, I suppose, you know. It's a lot of noise.
And that took the steam out of the situation?
Yes. Because the thing about Chinese, you never lost your temper with them. And if you smiled And they when we explained who we were, they were pretty good. They were only after a few bob because they were hungry and things like this. They weren't politically motivated.
So it's very interesting you're going into the communist area. You know, and I wonder how you were. This would have been your first contacts with the communists.
Yes.
How did they impress you? How did the sort of organisation?
Well, they impressed me, first of all, by their efficiency. They were very good. The second thing was that I was impressed by the young, keen, enthusiastic students who disguised themselves often as peasants with their books and glasses and that hidden in baskets, you know, the diamond pole thing, and walked hundreds of miles so they might attend a communist university. And these young people impressed me because they were, many of them had come from good homes, but were prepared to go a long way to do further study for what they called the new democracy. And I've often said to people, I believe that the secret of success for the Chinese was, for the ordinary people, was that first of all, they knew what they believed. They weren't woolly at all in their thinking. I mean, probably they'd been indoctrinated, that's fair enough, but also they knew fairly precisely what they believed. The other thing was they were willing to sacrifice, given up, many of them gave up their good homes to go and do this. The other thing is they were terribly enthusiastic. And wherever they went, they talked about the new democracy, as it was called in those. And I think it was these three attributes that really meant how the Chinese ultimately conquered the whole of China.
How the communists.
Yeah, communists. And I think the fact that they really knew what they believed. Of course, the other thing was the poor old Kuomintang at one stage were getting fairly demoralised. There was a lot of graft and corruption and so on. Yeah.